This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we've got a special show on the life of the great journalist Glenn Ford and the book that was just published, the posthumously book, The Black Agenda. In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we have a special place for attorney and professor Holly McGuigan.
Holly is a criminal defense attorney. You'll not just like her, you'll love her. And her storytelling, like every defense lawyer, is beyond belief.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Bogosian.
Glenn Ford died of lung cancer last summer in July at the age of 71. Cornel West wrote that he was the most brilliant, courageous, and consistent writer and journalist in the black radical and independent tradition of his generation. Of himself, Glenn said, "I'm a black nationalist and a socialist." He had been the executive editor of the Black Agenda Report, which he helped found in 2006. Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with three people closest to Glenn Ford. We have his daughter, Tonya Rutherford, Margaret Kimberly, and Ajamu Baraka. Just before he died, Glenn was able to complete the manuscript for the book, The Black Agenda. The book is available from Orr Books. Margaret Kimberly worked with Glenn for 18 years. She wrote the introduction to his book and is now the managing editor of the Black Agenda Report. Glenn was her mentor and teacher. Ajamu Baraka is an editor and frequent contributor to BAR. He's the executive director of the Black Alliance for Peace. He ran as the Green Party candidate for president in 2016. And finally, Raymond Nat Turner, who will read a poem he wrote especially for Glenn Ford, is the poet in residence at BAR. I'm in the studio with my friend Michael G. Haskins, who's on the board, and we're having a show about the late Glenn Ford and his book, The Black Agenda. Cornel West wrote that he was the most brilliant, courageous, and consistent writer and journalist in the black radical and independent tradition of his generation. Chris Hedges wrote that Glenn was a talented and brilliant writer, gifted with an acerbic sense of humor and an uncompromising integrity and courage. He'll be very hard to replace. Of himself, Glenn said, "I'm a black nationalist and a socialist." He had been the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, BAR, which he helped found in 2006. Today, we have with us on Law and Disorder three people closest to Glenn Ford. We've got Tonya Rutherford, Margaret Kimberly, and Ajamu Baraka. Just before he died, Glenn was able to complete the manuscript for his book, The Black Agenda. I'm in the studio. Margaret's in Harlem. Tonya's in Washington, D.C., and Ajamu's in Columbia. Modern technology allows us to all be with you at the same time. Margaret Kimberly worked with Glenn for 18 years. She wrote the preface to the book, The Black Agenda, and is now managing the Black Agenda Report. Glenn was her mentor and teacher. Ajamu Baraka is an editor and frequent contributor to BAR. He's the executive director of the Black Alliance for Peace. He ran as the Green Party candidate for vice president in 2016. Tonya Rutherford practices law in Washington, D.C. She's Glenn Ford's daughter. Tonya, Ajamu, Margaret, good to have you on Law and Disorder, and in your case, Ajamu and Margaret, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's start off with you, Tonya. You're Glenn's daughter. You've known him the longest. Tell us, what was he like? What experiences did you have that made you political and gave you the values that you have?
First of all, I'd like to say power to the people, and thanks for having us, Michael. Thanks so much for keeping my father's legacy alive. My father was a man of words, as you know, big words, colorful phrases. He had dramatic facial expressions and substantial hand gesticulations. He had a big personality, and he was a lot of fun. We laughed a lot, and we obviously spoke a lot about the liberation of black people. He was very serious about the full emancipation and self-determination of black people throughout the globe. That was his passion, if you will. That's a major part of his legacy that I've inherited. And in my own way, I've incorporated into who I am and what I have done and will do with my life. You know, I learned a lot from my father's words, and I'm still learning from his words because he is so well published, including the essays in his book that you mentioned, The Black Agenda, which I'm so glad that he was able to complete before his passing. The book is a political anthology. It's rich. It's informative. College courses and syllabi should include this book. So I learn and will continue to learn from his words, even after his transition from elder to ancestor. Michael, his actions also helped shape me really significantly. At least three of them come to mind. The first is his discipline. As an old school print, radio, and TV journalist, my father had tremendous discipline. I have never met a more disciplined person. As a broadcast journalist, he understood and believed in deadlines. Those of us who are his family lovingly recall him famously saying every week, Tuesday is my 14-hour workday. That's the day that he labored over his story for the week in preparation for the publication deadline on Wednesday. And wherever he could, he worked and published Black Agenda reports, whether from the dialysis chair, the hospital bed, Chinatown bus to and from D.C. He knew that the liberation of Black people was important, and in fact, it was intensely personal for him. That was his life, and that's why he was so disciplined. The second thing that I learned from him is to have the courage to be a critical voice. Some people want to be liked. My father wanted to do and say what he believed was right. I learned the term moral authority from him. I would be remiss if I didn't note on this day, the day that we celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. King, that Dr. King, particularly in the last years of his life, was a critical voice in the face of death on the triple evil: racism, militarism, and materialism. And contrary to the sanitized image that mainstream media portrays of Dr. King, he had and was so much more than a dream. Indeed, he said that his dream had turned into a nightmare. So like my father, he had the courage to be a critical voice. It took courage for my father to speak on behalf of and to be the voice of Black soldiers when he was in the Army. It took courage to take the mic at a radio station in Augusta, Georgia, and speak truth to power and give voice to the powerless. It took courage to speak against Obama. And then the third thing that I would say that my father gave to me was the permission to tell his story, to tell my story. He didn't ask for permission. Frankly, Michael, few people, if anyone, would have ever given him permission to say the things that he said. He just did it. He took it. And if he found himself working in an environment where he couldn't do that, he started his own venture. He showed me that we are the authors of our own stories, and we give ourselves permission to tell our viewpoint in the way that's most authentic and true to who we are. So those are just a few of the ways that my father shaped who I am and who I hope to be.
Thank you, Tanya. Tanya, please tell us about your grandmother, your father's mother, Shirley, and your grandfather, your father's father, Rudy. She was a white Communist Party activist in New Jersey, and he was a well-known Black radio disc jockey. What a legacy, what a lineage. Could you talk about them for us, please?
Absolutely. And yes, what a legacy and lineage. My father was a wonderful blend of his mother and father. He got his political links from my grandma, Shirley. He got an early start in left politics, handing out political flyers with her when he was a very young child. My cousin David Rutherford wrote a wonderful blog entry in 2014 about my grandmother's life. And as cousin David noted in that blog entry, while still in high school, Grandma Shirley worked to eradicate de facto segregation in housing and education in Jersey City, beginning her career as a social justice activist. She worked on local elections and was the human rights director for Newark's first Black mayor, Kenneth Gibson. So my father got his political fire and journalistic inspiration from his mother. And he got his love for R&B music from his father, Rudy. He would hang out with his father at the radio station in Columbus, Georgia, and he met tons of famous singers, Jackie Wilson, Aretha Franklin, just to name a few. And he and his brother David would go to nightclubs with my grandfather or where he was working. My grandfather was the first black man in the South to host a non-gospel TV show. It was called Rocking with the Deuce. And he also was inducted into the Black Radio Hall of Fame in the late 80s. My father combined both his parents' interests and their influence into something that I call uniquely Glenn. He called it his bifurcated brain. He combined his love for black music, black politics and activism and broadcast journalism all into one and created something uniquely Glenn Ford. So there is and will never be another person like him.
Thanks, Tanya. Margaret Kimberly and Ajamu Baraka, let's bring you into the conversation. What was it like to work with Glenn Ford? When I was scheduling him for an appearance on Law & Disorder Radio, he told me that he edited the Black Agenda Report sitting in a chair undergoing dialysis at the Veterans Hospital in New Jersey. And when I was working with him on his book, The Black Agenda, he wrote the introduction in the back seat of a car driving from New Jersey to Washington, D.C. That's the kind of extraordinary discipline he had. What was it like for you two working with him? Margaret, you first.
Well, it was an amazing experience working with Glenn. The first thing I want to say is that he was always very encouraging. He was a mentor to me and to other people. He took a chance on me back in the days of Black Commentator, which we left in 2006 to establish Black Agenda Report. But I had written a letter to the editor that it was very good, and I said, can I write something else? And he said yes, and the rest is history. He wanted to bring new people in. He also, not only did he help and encourage me as a writer, but he also was a person who played quite a role in shaping the politics that I have now. He was a political educator, if you will. He was very, very knowledgeable about the world, very knowledgeable about history, a Marxist. And I had not known anyone with those politics before I met him. And he really broadened my world and broadened my horizons politically and intellectually. And I have to say that if I hadn't met Glenn, I don't think I would have achieved the things I have since that time, becoming a published author, being asked to speak and to write all over the world. None of those things would have happened had I not met Glenn Ford.
Thank you, Margaret. Ajamu, how about your experiences?
Glenn was, as everyone knows, an amazing individual. He took a chance on me also in the sense that while I had written some, you know, academic stuff, and actually even written a few things for Black Commentary, I think in the early days of Black Agenda Report, I didn't really consider myself a writer. But as soon as I finished up leading a human rights organization that freed me to really get back into the public domain in a different kind of way, I contacted Glenn. I saw the kind of courageous positions that Black Agenda Report was taking regarding Obama, and people had to be reminded how difficult that was in the Black community to be opposed to this new face of U.S. Imperialism.
Thank you, Ajamu Baraka. Go to a brief five-minute talk that Glenn Ford gave on Obama's continuation of imperialism. That courageous journalist, Glenn Ford, speaking out when virtually the entire left, black and white, were supporting Obama, but not Glenn Ford.
An American foreign policy that is always in a state of aggressive war against numerous peoples around the globe simultaneously, when we begin to understand that this is normal behavior for the people who run the United States, then we will begin to see the outlines of a system. And that system, of course, is U.S. imperialism. Imperialism is constantly at war because its purpose is to dominate the planet so that the many can exploit the few. Those can be exploited by the few, those few being mainly located in New York and London. Since peoples around the planet constantly resist being dominated by these rich white men, imperialism must be constantly at war. War is imperialism's normal state of being. This is the great truth that must be hidden. Therefore, the very words U.S. imperialism are a kind of taboo not to be spoken in polite society in the United States. In fact, we even have so-called peace organizations that won't say the word U.S. imperialism. If you pretend, like they do, that there is no such thing as U.S. imperialism, then every war is a kind of property of a particular president. So we get people talking about Iraq and Afghanistan as George Bush's wars, not the Democrat Bill Clinton's wars, although President Clinton mercilessly bombed Iraq into ruins and was responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis through the savage sanctions campaign and through destruction of Iraq's infrastructure before there was Bush's war. They don't talk about President Bush the First, who turned on his and President Reagan's former ally, Saddam Hussein, and attacked him. And they don't talk about Eisenhower and Kennedy and the Nixon administration that used Saddam Hussein to kill Iraqi communists. The fact is that the British and the Americans have always been at war against the Iraqi people. But when we single out the latest installment of that constant war and call it Bush's war, we make it George Bush's property, not part of the continuity of U.S. imperial warfare. It becomes something that Barack Obama inherits from Bush, along with Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia. An inheritance that Obama can then claim that he did not want, that it was forced upon him, that he reluctantly inherited this thing. It's like Bush is the devil, and the devil is making Obama wage wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia. And too many of our people actually believe that. They think that's true. They say, oh, Barack inherited those wars from Bush. He didn't start them. He just got them. What Barack Obama did was join and compete to become the leader of the system of U.S. imperialism. Obama didn't inherit anything. He fought hard to win the approval of Wall Street and the other moneyed classes to bankroll his candidacy so that he could represent them and their interests on the world stage. He didn't inherit that. He worked hard for it.
That's what The Black Agenda, Glenn Ford's new book, is all about. He had a penetrating intelligence, wit, and an understanding that was unparalleled in our generation. Margaret, you were with Glenn when Barr was launched. Jaimu, you came in a little later. What was the mission of Barr? That is to say, what were your and Glenn's politics? How did you understand the world, and what could you do about it? Margaret, you go first.
Yes, well, Black Agenda Report, we have a very easy to understand tagline: news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. Very black and very left. And I always say left, not Democratic Party, but left, socialist. In some cases, Glenn called himself a Marxist. He was that. And so our understanding, my understanding was that we were going to present to our readers history that they may not know, information that was marginalized, a point of view that is often marginalized. Glenn was very proud of the fact that Black Agenda Report is the only online Black-oriented website that did original reporting from this point of view. He was very happy when a few years, I suppose it was 2016, right after the election, and this Propaganda or Not website showed up and was presented by the Washington Post, meaning Jeff Bezos wanted it to exist, meaning that the Democratic Party wanted it to exist, and Prop or Not was supposed to expose people and organizations and sites that were pro-Russian. And Black Agenda Report ended up on the list. And I remember Glenn being very happy because he knew what the goal of it was to censor on behalf of the Democratic Party. And he felt that ending up on this list gave us great credibility. He also wanted to be and was a leader in Black thought and Black radical thought and making sure that point of view didn't disappear. For a variety of reasons, Black politics, well, the politics of the entire country were purposefully moved further to the right, and that did not exclude Black people. So he wanted to make sure that the voice of Black people, which then as now tends to be more left than that of the rest of the country, and saying that there is a Black polity, that there are Black politics, which is not the same as having Black politicians, but that Black politics be represented in the media.
Thank you, Margaret Kimberly. We're talking with her, Ajamu Baraka, and Tanya Rutherford. Tanya, we come to you. Could you tell us how you and Glenn understood the world and what you could do in it?
Sure. I would say that my father believed in Black people's right to self-determination wherever we are in the diaspora. And that, for him, is what it meant to be a Black nationalist. He believed that we, as Black Americans, constitute a nation, that we are a nation within a nation. And that's how he saw the world, that we, wherever we are in the world, that we have the right to determine how our cities are organized, how our neighborhoods are policed. And socialism is the political context and the backdrop in which he believed that self-determination should exist and operate for Black folks. So I would say that's how he saw the world.
Margaret Kimberly, in the preface that you wrote to his posthumously published book, The Black Agenda, you wrote that Glenn was the, quote, penultimate race man. I wanted to ask you what you meant about that, and then ask you if you would please read from your preface on page 11.
Sure. The term race man or race person is very old school. It's something that you don't hear much anymore. But it refers to Black people who put Black people, their concerns, and their rights in the forefront. And that's who Glenn was. It was funny. If I went on a trip or something, I would, you know, I'd come back and tell Glenn about it. And he would always ask me, how many Black people live there? You know, which is kind of funny. But those were his politics. How were Black people going to be impacted by a certain election, by a certain action? And that is why he was so unimpressed with and so critical of many Black politicians who, because of the nature of this country and the nature of what they do, often don't represent the needs of Black people. He put Black people first in his political thinking. And that's why I described him as a race man. He was most certainly that. And so now I will read from this page from the preface that I wrote. Glenn Ford was the first person to call attention to Cory Booker's astonishing rise to prominence. In Booker's first campaign for mayor of Newark, New Jersey, it was Ford who revealed his ties to right-wing organizations such as the Manhattan Institute and the and the Bradley Foundation. His reporting was so good that Booker's opponent distributed the Black Commentator articles, which exposed the effort to groom a black politician willing to carry out austerity, school privatization, and other right-wing initiatives that would ordinarily be anathema to black voters. Booker was not the only member of what Black Agenda Report referred to as, quote, the black misleadership class, unquote. The politicians and others thought of as leaders are not independent actors. Instead, they are given money, positions, and some degree of access to the world of the elites in order to influence black people and get buy-in for the neoliberal consensus. Glenn Ford had a keen eye for their activities, and as a result, Black Agenda Report did not succumb to the imperative to elevate and protect the black faith in a high place. Nowhere was that more obvious than in his coverage of Barack Obama's campaign and his presidential administration. While other black leftists changed their political religion in the wake of Obama's 2008 success, Glenn Ford consistently maintained an independent political stance. He called Obama and Hillary Clinton political twins who would offer up the same policy which had so badly failed black people. Ford saw what was coming when he described Obama's ascendancy as the favorite of the 1% and marketing which made him appear to be progressive as, quote, Goldman Sachs and the anti-war movement being on the same page, unquote. Ford regularly exposed the corrupting influence that Obama's presidency had on black Americans and their long history of radical politics. Once the most left-leaning cohort in the country, the determination to protect Obama pushed a group that always showed the least support for wars and foreign interventions into cheerleaders for whatever their idol cooked up domestically or internationally. Ford pointed out that in 2002, only four members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted in favor of giving George W. Bush authorization to invade Iraq. While in 2011, more than half of that group, 24 CBC members, voted to support the U.S. and NATO bombing of Libya. The final success in destroying that nation was a war crime, but the people who once would have called it such were largely silent.
That's powerful stuff, Margaret. Thank you very much.
For Brother Glenn, when an elder dies, a library burns to the ground. African proverb, gender adjusted. One, no bald build back better slogans for a burned Bruce library, a Glenn library gone. Pick up the ashes, carry on, spreading them on. New crops. Two, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. Black cat dander, goober dust, rabbit foot, spookism, viral droplets of Madison Avenue messaging. Yes, we can and bottle Jim Jones juice for regime change. You can believe in. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. Droplets of dung from charlatans riding bareback backwards on donkeys every 2 to 4 years, trapping Negroes in pigment of their imaginations, whooping, hollering, happy dancing on ice for the audacity of dope. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. Ecstasy, rhapsody of nodding icons swept up in rapture of cool-aided euphoria. Mentors becoming brutes when facts effed up their highs. Couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe, quarantined, in time out, socially distanced, isolated, unappreciated, wasting away out west, killing me softly for my words, my poem, the coming of Christ. 3. Then one slow blues Saturday, a steel velvet rap, voice of spirit stirring, North Star Stripe issued from the radio, snapping me to attention. It possessed thunderous timbre, freedom's journal, liberator, emancipator tone. Snatching my collar, it held me. It held Douglas, DNA infecting my marrow. It had shed it. Reading Newswire copy on the air at age 11. It harnessed horsepower that even the godfather of soul would say it loud, rechristening it Ford. Ida B. Ferocity, it commanded KPFA's colossal signal, showering ice cold WikiLeaks over one third of the Golden State. It flared hot blue flames and melted masks of misleaders guarding freezers stuffed with corporate cash. Possessing laser precision, it surgically removed word walls metastasized in the mind of a slutty professor, and it taught little Negroes in Teddy P tones, you gotta let him go, if it looks like another book of TKO or more effective evil. And it continued crescendoing from studios, stages, street corners, churches, bookstores, bars, lecture halls, flatbed trucks, igniting conscious explosions with welcome forward fuses, speaking truth to the people, power to the people, power to the people. Power to the people. 4. Well done, brother. May the ancestors be pleased with you, kneeling near 7 mounds, saluting the 7 trees, guarding them on African burial ground as you leave lower Manhattan, seeing Sun Ra, Saturn, beyond.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In our Lawyers You'll Like series, we're joined now by Holly McGuigan, a professor of clinical law at New York University School of Law. Holly teaches at the Comparative Criminal Justice Clinic at NYU. She serves on the boards of directors at the National Clearinghouse for the Defense of Battered Women and the William Moses Kunstler Fund for Racial Justice. Holly is a past co-president of the Society of American Law Teachers, SALT, which is the largest membership organization of law professors in the United States. She's about to be honored by SALT in January as a great law teacher.
Because I think you were studying medieval literature, English literature, and then wound up in law school. Tell us about that.
Well, I was doing medieval history, actually, and I was at Berkeley, and it was 1967, and Oakland stopped the draft. Well, And I was still interested in medieval history, but I got very interested in the anti-war politics. I'd been interested in anti-racism politics before, but I always thought I could do my main intellectual love and my political love simultaneously. They didn't have to be the same. And I hated lawyers. I really hated lawyers. They were boring. They talked about themselves all the time. They only had stories about their cases and how great they were. And they would never post bail when people got arrested. So I had like very little use for lawyers. But I went to a meeting. I had moved to Santa Cruz from Berkeley. And I was at a meeting planning the People's Park demonstrations in 68 in California. And this guy takes the microphone and starts reading. And there's another guy in the back of the room who starts ululating. It's like right out of Battle of Algiers. It's unbelievable.
What's ululating mean? That's a big word for someone like me.
It's like making a sound that I can't make. But it's like making a kind of keening, howling, keening. Wonderful sound. And he came running up to the mic and grabbed the mic and said, every time a suit tries to read you something, stop them. There's all these surveillance cameras here.
What's a suit? Like a lawyer wearing a suit?
Like a person wearing a suit. And he says, there's all these surveillance cameras. They all know you're here. This means this. What he's reading is a John and Jane Doe injunction against the march on People's Park. They've got cameras. They can prove every one of you is in criminal contempt if you now do the march, if you let him finish reading the injunction. Now, just don't ever let anybody. Just shriek, yell, do whatever sound you want to make. I thought that was so cool. That was the best. The most useful thing I'd ever seen a lawyer do in my life. So I went home. My fiancé was applying to law schools, despite my complaints. You're much too nice a person to go to law school. You shouldn't go to law school. And I was applying to history PhD programs. So I went home and I said, give me every application you haven't filled out. And I took it to a copy shop and I made copies. And so I applied to every law school whose application he hadn't finished. We were right up against the deadline.
Great way to select the law schools.
It's as good as any, you know.
Or a profession, for that matter.
Worked out well.
Which one accepted you?
We decided to go to the school that accepted us both and gave me the most money, because his family had money, but mine didn't. And that was the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which is where I stayed then for 17 years.
Well, let's talk about that, because you had the one of the preeminent constitutional and criminal defense law firms, Carey's, Rudofsky, and McGuigan in Philadelphia. And you were there during a time when Frank Rizzo was the police chief.
And then the mayor.
And then the mayor. And we'll talk about Frank also. But I want to talk to you about your law practice and the kind of cases that you took there and how you developed into a criminal defense lawyer and a constitutional lawyer, because that leads right into your then becoming a teacher. But let's talk about the old days in Philly. How'd you start out?
That. Well, first, I started out as a public defender. I loved being a public defender. It was the beginning and end of everything I had hoped it would be. It was just great. And that's where I met David Rudofsky and David Carey's. They were then defenders when I was a student. And after they went out on their own, they invited me to join them. And I kept putting it off because I loved being a defender so much. I knew that working with them would be fabulous. I mean, there's no question. I just kept deferring it till finally they said, you know what, we can't wait any longer. We have to go someplace else. What?
But let me ask you, I understand you loved being a public defender, but I've had other friends who've been public defenders. And, you know, it's not an exactly wonderful job in certain ways, because the people you meet have been so oppressed by the system, and your chances of giving them anything meaningful is very hard. I mean, I've had friends who just said, I can't stand being in here. I can't go into the pens anymore with 50, you know, African Americans or Latinos that are just being harassed by this society. So how did you psychologically, I mean, I just,
I don't know the answer to that, except that, first of all, in Philadelphia, there was much more actual litigation, not just motion litigation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that here in New York City, but actual trials, lots of trials. So you really had a shot at getting somebody off. And you had a sense, there was an analysis that people were doing life on the installment plan. and that what you needed was to do what you could to kick them loose any particular time. And your clients understood that. There were limits to what you could do. The system wasn't the least bit fair. But people really appreciated the fact that there were lawyers at the Defender Association who were willing to give everything they had to get them out. And so it inspired you. You know what I mean? There was never a morning you got up and thought, why am I doing this? You know, and it was in many ways a difficult office to work in, because instead of representing a client from beginning to end, which you didn't get to do until it was a major case, for the life on the installment plan cases, you know, the ordinary misdemeanors and low-level felonies, it was what's called vertical representation. You represented a room. But even so, you got to know people. So when you went to the jail, there were people who called your name and you knew their names. And it was, you know, it was a community in its own odd way. And it was very difficult for me to leave it. I found it very painful to leave.
But did you have any... How many years were you there, Holly?
I was there 3 years.
So you didn't really get to the highest level death penalty cases, right?
And there weren't then. There was no death penalty in Pennsylvania then. So I got to the
highest. It's a Quaker state, Michael.
Right.
No, there is now.
Yes, right. There is now, for sure. But you moved quite quickly if you worked hard in that office. So I was doing major felonies within a couple years. Yeah.
Let's... going to private practice now.
Okay.
You go on with Carries and Radovsky, who I sat next to in law school because I'm Smith and he's R, and that's how it was arranged at NYU. But anyway, he goes to Philly. You wind up in Philly. They invite you to join the firm. It was one of those famous movement firms. Talk about what the three of you did.
Well, we did actually a lot of different things. David Carries was very focused on constitutional litigation and government misconduct. Not to say he didn't do criminal stuff. He did the Camden 28, which was a big draft-resisting case in the late 70s. And Dave Carries did a lot of police misconduct and some criminal defense. And my interest was more in the criminal defense. I liked that part better. I did police misconduct because the legal worker in that office, Jema Abdu, who then came to New York and was office staff for the National Office of the National Lawyers Guild. JMO was really a brilliant litigator, and she just gave me my marching orders and told me what to do, and so I did what she said. So it was a mix of things, and I did a lot of grand jury stuff in that time.
But that was political, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of cases, like...
Like the Patty Hearst grand jury was one of the first ones. It's where I met Bill Kunstler and Margie Ratner, now Margaret Ratner Kunstler.
Most people won't know what the Patty Hearst case was.
Well, it was. There was a grand jury convened. It was actually, it met all over the country, or several of them met, to investigate the alleged transportation of Patty Hearst by the Symbionese Liberation Army from California, where she had been captured, to...
Captured by
the Symbionese Liberation Army.
It's a great story.
It's one of the great stories. At that time, I was involved with a man who was working for Mo Udall for president. And Mo Udall said something that annoyed me about the SLA. And Paul Tully calls me up and he says, let me just understand this. I don't get to come home until Mo goes on the network and says the SLA are my kind of people.
Again, the SLA is Symbionese Liberation Army. Right. Patty Hearst was, of course, an heir to the...
Right, the Hearst fortune.
Fortune.
Right.
And she's kidnapped. She's, like, not necessarily part of anything.
No,
she's just kidnapped.
No. Kidnapped because she was a Hearst.
Right.
No, it was nothing she did. Nothing she did. So anyway, so these grand juries were convened, and I got a call from the Center for Constitutional Rights, about which you two know everything there is to know, and I bet your listeners do also. And I got a call just about being emergency counsel if there was a stay requested from a Harrisburg grand jury. And I was very excited, because on the phone were Bill Kunstler and Rhonda Copeland and all these people whose names I knew but I didn't know. And they're explaining what they want me to do as if we were in the Second Circuit it's a very New York thing. You assume the way things work in New York is the way they work everywhere. And that if everybody says that's not how they work, they think you just don't get it. So I was explaining the way the Third Circuit works. And I said, I need more. I need you to send me the papers. I need some reason to say why we have to wait for Bill and Doris and whoever else to get here. Because otherwise, they'll just make me argue. Oh, no, they – I said – trust me, this is the Third Circuit. This is a different place. This is what they do. You file an emergency appeal, an application for a stay. They get a judge who's available. You have to go in. So it was apparently they hung up the phone then and said, we got a live one in Philadelphia. Let's rope her in. So that's how I got involved. And it was fun. We went all over. And we knew ultimately we were going to lose. You always lose. But you can cause a lot of delay and quite a bit of havoc if you're creative and energetic.
Were there witnesses you were representing in front of the grand jury?
Yeah. I represented Jay Weiner, who was then a sports writer who'd been blackballed because of his connection with the sports left. Remember Jack Scott and Mickey Scott in the Mexico Olympics?
And the African-Americans who raised their fists.
Exactly.
And they were involved with those people.
Yes. Right. So he was supposed to, after being graduated from college, go to local, I won't name it because I'm actually kind of fond of this newspaper, but a local newspaper that then withdrew the job offer. And he was working as a cook, actually not a bad cook at all, in a local vegetarian eatery in Philadelphia until the grand jury was over. He did some time. He was at Allenwood. But he got good advice from other clients of mine. So he
refused to testify.
He refused to testify and was held in contempt.
And the issue again was how the kidnapping and transportation.
It was any information about it. He wouldn't give any information at all about what he may have known about what his friends were up to.
Because they're looking for Patty Hearst everywhere, right, at this point.
Right. At this point, they're looking for Patty Hearst or anybody who might have been involved in her kidnapping and transportation. This is after they had firebombed that house in Oakland. I mean, this was after a lot of tragedy. And so he ended up going to prison, but not for all that long, because one of the things you can do is then torture the judge until he lets him out. So we did that, and we got him out. So it could have been worse.
Let's talk about some more of your cases while you were doing criminal defense law in Philadelphia, because at that time Frank Rizzo was unfortunately around. Talk to us about him and the contention between your firm and his policies.
Well, he was a killer. I mean, there's no question. Under his tenure as commissioner of police and then as mayor, more people died as a result of police actions than before or since. I mean, one of the amazing things was that the next mayor, who was no great shakes, saw the number of deaths decrease by 33% just in the first 6 months of his time. It was a time when police were really green-lighted to do whatever they wanted and told it was the right thing to do. I don't mean to suggest that all the police started out homicidal. What I mean to suggest is this was a situation in which from the top down came the message, if you're a good cop, then you're going to take people out however you think you need to. And he himself was very sporty about it. You know, he liked to go out in a cummerbund in his night clothes with a nightstick stuck in his tuxedo cummerbund and round people up. I mean, and humiliate people. I mean,
look what he did to the Panthers.
Exactly. I was thinking about his invasion of the Black Panther Party headquarters in Philadelphia and his bringing out everybody who was found in there and forcing them to strip and stand naked on the street in the cold while he walks behind them wielding his nightstick. It was gross. It was horrible. It was really a very, very bad time.
So what did you folks at the law firm do litigation-wise in this situation?
We did a lot of criminal defense, of course, and a lot of litigation against the police tactics and at all different levels, right? I mean, David and David did a lot of excessive force litigation, a lot of illegal search litigation. I tended to do litigation about people who were targeted more because of who they were. But together we did a lot. And the reality is, in that kind of situation, organizing is absolutely as important as litigating. And it was hard sometimes to keep your eye on the ball, you know what I mean, to remind yourselves that the litigation was one piece of a strategy, that unless people made it clear that they weren't going to tolerate this police violence, a judge's ruling or a jury's decision wasn't going to matter that much. But it's interesting. You get involved in litigation, and then you think, oh, this is it. This is it. This is the greatest. And people who were normally wearing thuggy clothes and feeling like they were wanted to show how tough they were are coming in little suits. And you say, Michael, what are you doing? He says, my mother's coming. You know, it's like so it's important. And the lawyers play into that a lot. I mean, you really have to keep being mindful of the fact that you cannot ask people to take time away from organizing for litigation, that the litigation has to be just part of the whole strategy.
Now, did you develop any kind of specialty while you were working with Carey's, Radofsky, and McGuigan?
Kind of by accident, I did, in a way. By the time we'd worked together for several years, I thought I knew about race and class bias in the courtroom as much as a white woman who was middle class could know. And then I got assigned to represent a woman who was accused of killing her abusive boyfriend. And I was just blown away by what happens when you add hatred of women to hatred of black people and hatred of poor people. It stunned me. It absolutely stunned me. I just had no idea. So, I mean, yes, I had some specialties before that. You know what I mean? I did some grand jury stuff, and I represented a lot of gay groups who were being harassed in various parts of the city. And I lots of, but this thing just stunned me. And I called the judge who assigned me to this homicide to say, why me? Why did you assign me to this? And he said, oh, you just came up next, you know. It was like Philadelphia was very corrupt at that time, so he was one of the few judges who didn't demand money to be on the list to get a... Oh, I'm telling you, judges would go by me in the hall and say, oh, McGuigan, you didn't give me anything this Christmas, not even one lousy bottle. You're not getting any assignments.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Judges would do things like they'd open the drawer in their chambers, and there'd be... you know, wads of bills, and they'd let you know what they wanted. Oh, I had one time I was litigating a motion to suppress, and the judge said, it's just about time for the lunch and recess. I bet between now and 2:15, you and your client will come up with 200 reasons why I should rule in his favor.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
That guy's cheap.
Stunning, right? So, well, it was a long time ago. And if you get 200 from everybody...
Right,
you see what I mean? It's not that cheap.
That's amazing.
And 200 is within reach for a lot of people.
Those are amazing stories.
It was an incredible time. Oh, but the specialty.
Not to solicit your specialty in bribing judges, but your specialty
not.
In
actually,
law.
I was famous for not bribing them. So this guy gave me this case because I didn't bribe anybody. I was like known for... so he assigned me this case for no particular reason. And I went... This is the first time, to my knowledge, I now realize I had represented a lot of women who'd been victimized by intimate partner violence. I just didn't recognize. I didn't know, you know. I just didn't know. But this was the first time that I was aware that that was what was going on. So I went to this restaurant where what happened was he attacked her in a restaurant and pushed her back through the tables. She fell out of her shoes. She was knocking things off the tables as she went by, asking people for help. This is what she tells me, crying out for people to help her because he's strangling her and she can barely breathe. And they get to the back of the restaurant where there's a carving table, and she picked up a knife and stabbed him in the arm, meaning to get him just in the arm to make him stop. But because of the knife was very sharp. They were in a restaurant. And because of a birth defect or a birth, you know, anomaly, his heart was very close to the chest of his wall. It was far, so the knife pierced his heart and he died instantly on the spot. So I hire an investigator and I say, go to this place, it's around the same time, and see if there are any witnesses, because it's a neighborhood place and maybe there are people who go there every evening for an early dinner. And the investigator calls me and says, you have to come here. I go, I do not have to come here. I'm in court tomorrow. Excuse me, Joe. You're the expert investigator, and I'm the litigant. I do not. Trust me. You have to stop whatever you're doing, and you have to come here. So wow. I went there, and there were all these people in the restaurant, including a couple guys sitting at the bar. And Joe turns to them and says, tell her what you just told me. So they all look around, and one guy kind of collects himself and says, basically what she had said to me. He describes the scene. It starts out, remember cigarette machines? It starts out by the cigarette machine just inside the door. And he's saying, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And she's asking for help and nobody's helping. And,
wow.
And I say to him, why didn't you help her? And he says, we feel so bad about it now. But at the time, we didn't know they weren't married.
What?
So I thought, okay, what? This is a whole new world.
Right. It would have been wrong.
If they'd been married, it would have been okay.
Right. So I called the Women's Self-Defense Project, and I said, I really need help. I don't have any idea how to pick a jury. It's like, how do you pick a jury in a case? I mean, I'm used to picking juries in street crimes and the odd federal case, but it's mainly where the focus is on a person for reasons that are hideous, not because of reasons of anything they actually did. I have no idea. So it changed everything for me. So I developed something of a specialty in women who kill men. There is that. Although I should hasten to say that some of my best friends are men.
I appreciate that. You married one of ours.
Yes, I'm saying that my own personal husband is a very nice man. Right?
Although Michael did just pull his chair 2 feet farther from
he
Holly.
Did.
Now, what year was this? Because this is the very beginning of really the establishment of this.
Of the notion of that the women could claim self-defense
right.
and be reasonable.
I
instead
think,
of
mid-'80s, right. earlier?
No, late 70s.
Late
70s,
started. Okay.
It was Liz Schneider was doing her work then in New York.
Right,
the Women's Self-Defense Project, right at the Center for Constitutional Rights, was doing their work. So it was the start, for me, this started in the late 70s. And then in the early 80s, a group in Philadelphia called Women Against Abuse began working. And they did advocacy for battered women accused of crime. And it made a huge difference. It meant that we could collaborate with people who were really knowledgeable about the dynamics of intimate partner violence and about who to use as expert witnesses if you decided to use an expert witness and about how to get in touch with them and what to do. It made a huge, huge difference.
Well, Holly, we so appreciate you being with us. And we call the segments Lawyers You'll Like, but in this case, it's Lawyers You'll Love.
Oh,
so Holly McGuigan, really fabulous.
It was fun. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Holly.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.